This is XTP Media.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson and welcome to episode 93 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. And in the background, that is the F-35. So today I'm here with Amanda and Beatrice and we're at the 2019 Royal Naval Air Station Yeovilton Air Day, which in Navy terms is of course HMS Heron. And just coming in to approach then is the F-35. It's its first appearance here. Made its first landing at Yeovilton, touch and go on Thursday, and here she comes. It's my first sight of the F-35, and gosh, it's just a beauty. So she's coming in dirty, flaps, wheels, everything else down.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. For takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
A few weeks ago, I was able to get access to the executive officer responsible for delivering the whole Air Day event, Lieutenant Colonel Neil Briggers Brighouse. What I wanted to find out from Colonel Brighouse first was what is an executive officer and what are his responsibilities for Air Day?
So I'm Lieutenant Colonel Neil Brighouse, Royal Marines, and I'm the executive officer here at RNS Yeovilton.
And you're the first Royal Marine to hold that role?
I am, yeah. So we've had one Royal Marine as CO Yeovilton before, but never had one as the XO.
Right, okay. And what does that role entail?
So essentially, I'm the second in command of the air station. So I work directly for the CO, for the Commodore. Yeah. And it's the day-to-day running of the air station, making sure that it operates smoothly as possible so that the squadrons and the units that are based here are able to get on with their daily job of operating the aircraft.
Yeah, and your Royal Marine career, or Royal Navy career, depending on what route you came through, can you tell us a little bit about what your career steps were and where the path was that got you into this role?
Yeah, certainly. So I joined the Royal Marines pretty much straight from A-levels as a 19-year-old. Through basic training, did my time as a troop commander, spent a bit of time working for Navy recruiting, and then decided to specialise as a pilot. Went through the standard flying training pipeline with my Royal Navy colleagues, onto the Sea King, and then a number of flying tours with the Sea King, and then other flying related jobs over the past 20 odd years or so.
Right, okay. And are you flying today? Are you still active?
Sadly, no. Flying a desk these days.
Do you miss it?
I do. Only every day I look out the window and see everybody else doing it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, at least you're here. At least you can see it. Tell us then a little bit about Air Day and the prep and the role that you have in preparing for Air Day.
So very similar to my day job, really. The Commodore is overall responsible for the day. I'm the event organiser, so I'm responsible to him for the command and control, the planning, the execution of everything, really, apart from the actual flying.
Right, okay, yeah, that's taken by the flying planning officers, understand that. When does the planning for air day start?
So it really starts pretty much as soon as the previous air day finishes.
Right.
So
do you do a debrief on what went right, what went wrong, you know, lessons learned?
There is.
Like
we'll do that. We'll have a wash up, and then we'll look at that. We'll have a review of all our orders and our processes and see what's what. So it's a little bit quieter in the autumn period,
yeah.
And then really from January onwards it starts to get busier, and then from Easter onwards it gets very, very busy.
Yeah, and a lot of international participants again this year. Actually, it's becoming a great show for seeing some of our cousins from abroad.
We've done really well over recent years. Lots of interesting stuff. There's some old favourites, of course,
yeah.
But we try and do our best to attract as many people as we can from around the world to give the public that chance just to see something a little bit different.
Yeah, and how do you go about attracting acts from, you know, the Middle East, from North America, from Europe? They're coming from all over.
So we've got, you know, the MOD and throughout the forces have got a network of defence attachés and embassies throughout the world. So it's
so it's
through that network and exploiting that and the contacts that they've got and inviting them. And hopefully the word gets around that Yeovilton's a great place to come, and you know, they're knocking on our door saying,
yeah,
can we come, please?
It's becoming one of the must-go-to air shows in the UK, isn't it?
It is. I mean, certainly over the last few years, you know, we've seen some of the other air shows dwindle and fall away. And Yeovilton...
Yeah.
Yeovilton's still one of the big ones that remains, really. So,
yeah.
and hopefully it will continue to be so.
And how important is Air Day to the Royal Navy and the Royal Marines?
So it's an opportunity, really, for us to get ourselves out there in the public eye. Fairly obviously, most of the Navy are around the coast, and Yeovilton isn't. So
yeah,
it gives us that access to a completely different audience that perhaps may not really have an understanding of the Navy or of what we do. So
yeah,
it's a fantastic opportunity from that respect.
Yeah, well, looking forward to the day. Well done for all the organising so far, but a bit of way to go. What do you still have to do in the coming week or two before the display?
So it's really just final checking of absolutely everything, making sure that everything's in place, making sure that the traffic management, people can get in, people can get out, people enjoy themselves, and it's done safely while we're here. But even right up until the day before, we'll be doing that last minute check of the weather and seeing how that affects us. Clearly the flying's very weather dependent, but just the people out on the showground, is it hot, is it cold, is it raining, how's it going to affect them, do we need to get more water in, and the like. So the planning never really stops until the last member of the public goes out of the gate, and then we start the next one.
Right, thank you very much and good luck for the day.
Thank you.
So performing now is the Spanish Navy's AV-8B Harrier 2. This one is operated by 9 Squadron, based in Rota in southern Spain. And it's been a long time since I've seen a Harrier display, so really enjoying this at the moment. She's coming in to do her slow approach and a hover. So here she comes in for the hover, the AV-8B Spanish Navy Harrier. As the build-up to the flying display begins, nothing gets passed without the inspection and approval of Lieutenant Commander Flying. This year, that role is held by Lieutenant Commander Flying Lee Kenners Kennington. I asked Commander Kennington about his background before teasing out what's involved in getting all these aircraft in place and organised, both on the ground but also in the air.
Hi Peter, my name's Lee Kennington, everyone calls me Kenners. I am Lieutenant Commander Flying here at Yeovilton.
And Kenners, what What's your background? What got you to be in the role you're in today? What's your career path?
So I am an observer by trade. I joined the Navy some 27, 28 years ago. I had attempted to join the Royal Air Force because I'm from Cambridgeshire originally, but I was deemed too old for the Air Force.
Right.
So thankfully, I ended up joining the Fleet Air Arm. I've been Fleet Air Arm through and through. I initially trained as an ASW observer, flying out of Cornwall with 820 and 810 Naval Air Squadrons, the Seeking Mark 6.
Okay.
I then...
What was the role?
Anti-submarine warfare.
Okay.
So I was predominantly on the aircraft carriers. I managed to go on all three of the old CVSs.
Okay.
And then a lot of Royal Fleet auxiliaries. So our ships that provide stores and support and ammunition to us.
Yeah.
I managed to do two global deployments, spent quite a lot of time at sea, before then moving up to Scotland to do search and rescue for 3 years.
Right, okay, on the Sea King as well.
Again, on the Sea King, the Sea King Mark V this time.
And you're at HMS Heron now. What's your role at HMS Heron?
So at Heron, I'm Lieutenant Commander Flying. So I jumped out of the Sea King in 2000, transferred across to the Lynx fleet, spent the next sort of 12 to 14 years on and off in the Lynx fleet whilst doing some desk jobs as well. And then I took up this role last September.
Okay, so what are the challenges you face for Air Day? What's your role as Lieutenant Commander Flying? What does that mean?
I'm the coordinator, really. I have a smashing team with me, three holdovers and also a dedicated reservist. And between the five of us, we're looking to bring as many interesting and varied acts here to Yeovilton for Air Day. We started working. I took over the job last September. My predecessor had already started work.
Yeah.
And I just continued. It's a year-round job.
Right.
There are peaks and troughs, and at the moment we're going into a big peak with 8 weeks to go. We've just submitted the information to the MAA, the Military Aviation Authority, to say we are definitely holding the air day,
yeah.
And these are the acts that are coming.
Right, okay. And what can we expect to see? What sort of aircraft can we expect to see at air day? There's a right mix at the moment.
There is. So we're hoping to open with a couple of Wasps and a Wessex. And we'll close with our Piasta Resistance, the Jungly Assault, the finale. And that'll be the closing. And in between that, we'll go from the very old to the very new.
Yeah.
The Swordfish should be with us, going all the way through to an F-35 doing a fly past.
Yeah, that'd be great. And the F-35, it's not landing, it's not staying, is it? Is it a...
It's a flypast only. They've got quite a lot of tasking in the build-up to Air Day.
Yeah.
And then post-Air Day, they've got a programme to go through with their aircraft,
right,
ready for the next tasking.
Okay.
So we had hoped for it for the weekend, but we're going to get the flypast.
Yeah.
Hopefully with a Navy pilot, but it could well be a Royal Air Force pilot.
All right, fingers crossed.
Indeed.
And an international community as well. French, Spanish, the Jordanians are coming, the Americans are coming. A great spread of international partners supporting Air Day.
It is. We have reached out to as many as we can. At the moment, confirmed acts, and I can't imagine a lot more coming in, but we're still working. But at the moment, we've got the Belgian F-16. He's returning in a great act last year. We've also got the C-17 coming over. We are, fingers crossed, going to get some static, some F-18s. We're just talking to them at the moment. They're over here on exercise, and they have two Navy pilots on exchange, Royal Navy pilots on exchange with them.
Okay.
So they're hoping to come here for Air Day, two F-18s.
That'd be great.
That will be great if it pulls off.
Yeah.
And then the other one is we are working hard to get a fly through by an Antonov. That's not confirmed yet.
Okay.
And that will be on the day, just flying big. Well, probably one of the biggest aircraft just flying through to excite the crowds.
Amazing, amazing. So tell me, what's involved in managing all those aircraft on the day? As we said, you know, you've got some historic, very slow moving aircraft, you've got helicopters, and you've got some fast movers there. What are challenges that face you as the chief flying officer involved in managing all of that?
We have a dedicated team, a flying control committee, but then we have sat above that the flying display director,
right.
Commander Phil Thornton, and I work directly with Phil, and we look at each act. We rely on the pilots, they're very professional, all of the display acts.
Yeah.
They tell us pretty much to the second how long their display is going to be. We then build in a minute or two to get one act off, the next act on, But at the same time, we need to get those acts airborne ready to fill that 1 or 2 minutes. Yeah. So it is a juggling act. Hopefully, we don't drop too many eggs to make an omelette, but we are looking all the time to keep the public entertained.
And what are going to be the key challenges for you in the week or so beforehand?
Getting all the aircraft in. We've got our static aircraft to get in and parked. And parked safely, because the airfield is still operating. We still have 10 squadrons flying here that have to maintain their operational output. So allowing them to use the airfield whilst also bringing all those acts in. And then we, the Flying Control Committee, need to look at all the acts that are going to display.
Yeah.
Other air shows in the UK may already have looked at them, which does our work for us, but some of them we need to look at their act and make sure it's eminently suitable in accordance with MAA guidelines.
Okay, and with recent challenges on the air show circuit, a few years ago, a lot of teams' displays have changed. The envelope they operate in is in a lot of instances a lot smaller. Does that affect the airspace around Yeovilton at all?
Airspace, no. We still give them the same amount of protection from other aircraft. We're constantly kept up to date by the MAA and the Civil Aviation Authority as well. Both us and all the display participants go to symposiums two or three during the year to bring us up to date with all the rules and make sure everyone's conforming to them, to make the display activity throughout the whole of Europe that little bit safer.
Yeah.
And I think the CAA and the MAA are sort of leading on that.
Well, looking forward to the day. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and hopefully no omelettes. Thanks, Peter.
Hi, Mick Oakey here, Managing Editor of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. The guys at Extended have once again kindly given me a few minutes to talk about our latest edition, TAH-28, officially published on July the 15th. The new issues arrived from the printers a few days ago, and I immediately posted a picture on our Facebook page. The issue has a particularly compelling cover photograph, a dynamic head-on view by Peter Lewis of a Swiss Dassault Mirage 3RS Amir, the photo recce variant, snaking through a vertiginous mountain valley. The snow-speckled background is nicely blurred, and the aircraft is pin-sharp, the sense of high-speed motion enhanced by the snaking wingtip vortices and the hot shimmer of the jetty flux. Oh, it's a delight. The Facebook post attracted comments ranging from, "That's a bit of a photo, is that?" to, "Oh, baby," with 3 exclamation marks. And it's not just Peter Lewis's flying photographs that make our cover story special. The Mirages were housed in a cavernous hangar tunnel carved into a mountainside, where a roof-mounted hoist system was used to pick them up from their parking bays, carry them over the top of their stablemates, and deposit them at the hangar mouth. We had to get special permission to include a very rare photo of that. Anyone excited by our cover story is likely to be equally excited by the rest of the issue. We explore the aeromedical aspects of piloting the Luftwaffe's Bachem-Natter rocket interceptor, not an article for the squeamish, Howard Hughes's special fondness for the Lockheed Constellation, World War II attempts to turn the Douglas DC-4E airliner and the C-54 transport into bombers, RAF heavy guns, and the political genesis of the Airbus programme, which nearly fell victim to what author Professor Keith Hayward calls a proto-Brexit. Oh, I said the B word again. That's another 50p in the tin. Finally, we publish a bizarre sequence of photographs showing a fairy barracuda being pushed over a cliff on the Welsh coast sometime in the mid-1940s to smash onto the rocks below. It's like the full-size equivalent of a schoolboy setting fire to an Airfix model. Why and exactly where did it happen? We investigate. Right, time's up. Remember, our journal is not on sale in newsagents, but you can order it online via our website, theaviationhistorian.com. Until next time, then, this is Mick Oakey talking to Extended.
Soon started replacing Supermarine C-3.
So, as the Navy Wings Seafury T20 performs, with the formation of Navy Wings as a result of the Navy withdrawing its finance from the historic flight, I talked to Commodore Jock Alexander. Now, he's the CEO of Navy Wings, about its immediate future, the aircraft it operates, and the future for the Royal Naval Historic Aircraft. Now, those eagle-eared amongst you may remember Commodore Alexander from our previous Air Day coverage episodes, as he was, of course, the air station's commanding officer up until a year or two ago. So here's Commodore Jock Alexander.
Okay, hi, Commodore Jock Alexander. Used to be in the Royal Navy in command in Yeovilton, but I left a couple of years ago and I'm now the chief executive of Navy Wings, the charity that keeps the old aeroplanes flying.
Right, now, last time we spoke, you were, I think you were in uniform, actually.
Possibly.
a very different role, and Navy Wings itself has been through an awful lot of change in the last year or two. Can you just explain to us what's happened?
Yeah, the charity is the Flying Navy Heritage Trust is the charity. We relaunched and branded it 2 years ago as Navy Wings. Essentially to make it future-proof, because we knew it was going to get bigger and we had to do a lot of work with it. That's worked quite well. And then the last year, there's been some more big changes, because the Royal Navy Historic Flight was disbanded, actually this year, by the Navy. And the plan now is we're working with the Navy to transfer the aeroplanes to us
right.
and operate them in the civil register.
Yeah.
We're just in that transition period right now, and the process has not gone as fast as we all thought it would of doing that. And therefore, sadly, the Swordfish sitting over there, although it's serviceable, will probably not be flying for Air Day
right.
because it's stuck in a process of regulatory.
Yeah,
correct.
Okay, so what aircraft has Navy Wings got and what can we expect to see flying in the coming years?
Well, certainly the two behind you here, the Sea Fury Twin Sea and the Wasp Helicopter, we've got them. They'll be flying for Air Day. The Sea Vixen over there, which did the wheels up landing a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and
we're flying in. Well, we've done a lot of work in that. We know there's a couple of cracks in it, we know where they are. There's at least 2 years' work there to get her flying again, but she's definitely recoverable.
Wow, okay.
And we're working on her, we're just keeping her ticking over right now, so the aim will be, that's a big project, so we've got to get the historic flight aeroplane squared away first.
Yeah.
Essentially that's transferring from the military register to the civil register, and there's a bit of work involved in that.
Right, okay.
And then the other aeroplanes are the historic ones that were owned by the Navy.
Yeah.
There's five of them, they'll hopefully come to us.
Right.
The other thing we did with Navy Wings is we launched an associate collection 2 years ago, and we thought we'd write to people in the UK that privately own old naval aeroplanes, of which there's quite a few.
Yeah.
I thought we'd get five or six. We've got 19 now.
Wow.
We've got one in Australia, believe it or not, a Harrier that's going to fly in Melbourne. But it means we've got aeroplanes from World War One now right through to almost the present day.
Wonderful.
As part of the collection. And the aim of that is that we can go around certain air shows, Yeovilton being one, where we aim to get at least 10 or 12 aeroplanes telling the story of naval aviation from the Naval Air Service in World War One. Yeah. Right through to the modern day.
Wow, fantastic, fantastic. And, you know, that transition over the last few years sort of felt like there was a bit of instability and what was the future, but it's looking really good.
Yeah, we've done a lot of work in the last couple of years to, I say, future-proof it.
Yeah.
So we're now on, you know, Facebook pages, we've got our own website, we tweet, I'm right on the edge of my knowledge base now, all that social media stuff we do.
Yeah.
And we've got lots of followers, that works really well. We've got a really good shop now, we sell things. So we're well established now. We've got a good supporter base of people joining up. And my plea, of course, would be for people to think about joining us as a supporter. It's £2.50 a month,
right.
So you won't even buy your cappuccino, but it might help save the aeroplanes for the nation.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much, Jock, for joining us.
My pleasure.
And good luck.
Thanks very much.
And here he is performing a barrel roll in towards us.
So Beatrice and me are just off to the Barracuda Restoration and the Fleet Air Arm Museum. Hopefully we can see what Dave, Tony, Will and Matt have got to say about the current restoration status. Beatrice has got her questions lined up as well.
Hello, my name's William Gibbs. I work for the Fleet Air Arm Museum in the restoration hangar restoring a barracuda.
And you're quite famous from your weekly updates. Well, if you don't mind me, don't mind me saying so. It's been a year since I was last here, but a lot's happened. Can you tell us about the restoration of the first airframe?
So DP872.
Yeah.
So we're currently restoring the cockpit section of DP872. We say halfway through all the tube work, with the starboard side nearly finished.
Yeah.
And the port side is ongoing.
Right, okay. Now, when we say restoration, you literally mean stripping every single nut, bolt, gasket, everything is being stripped down, isn't it?
Everything is going to be stripped down, right down to the bare bones, and then rebuilt.
Yeah.
So the process is to use as much of DP872 as possible.
Yeah.
If we can't use DP872, we will then go to our next best part out of all the barracuda crash sites that we have.
Yeah.
If that's not available or can't be used, then we will make new.
Okay.
But that's not the, you know, we're just trying to use as much original as possible.
Yeah. And what's your background in being able to do this? Because we see the Facebook updates on the barracuda page. And by the way, if you don't subscribe, you should do to that. We see the meticulous detail you put into that, but what's your background in being able to have those skills and experience?
Well, luckily, I mean, my dad was an engineer, so I've always been brought up around engineering. I did my work experience here when I was at school, and was lucky enough to be offered a job. So
okay.
I left school, came here, did a 5-year apprenticeship with the Westlands Apprentices at Yeovil College, and just built on that, basically.
Yeah. So how long do you think the rest of the restoration will take for DP872?
How long's a piece of string? I mean, we can't put a timescale on it at the moment.
Yeah.
That's a really difficult question for me to answer,
okay,
Peter.
Don't worry. Well, listen, let's talk about the project that's literally surfaced, excuse the pun, this year. There are a lot of parts in the front. Explain to us where they've come from.
So these parts have all come out of the Solent. So this, if it's the aircraft we think it is, it crashed. It took off from Daedalus. Had engine troubles, couldn't make climbing speed, and ditched in the sea.
Okay. What model was that? What Barracuda model was that?
So it's a Mark II.
It was a Mark II.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. You're looking to get as many pieces from that and use in this restoration. Is that the plan?
Definitely, yeah, as much as we can.
And they look to me, and the untrained engineer and I, to not be much, just a bag of corroded bits and pieces. How much of that do you think you can realistically salvage?
From looking at the wreck so far, all the steel components that we have, I say 90 to 95% of the steel components we can use.
Wow.
They've all been encased in crustacean.
Yeah.
Take the crustacean off, and they're made yesterday, basically.
Right. And, really. And did I see something about some hydraulics and air steel being in some of the parts?
Yeah. So we took one of the accumulators apart, and it was still charged.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Still charged up.
Wow. Okay. So again, just a question on the parts there. What's the plan for those? What's the sort of timetable for getting those integrated?
It's just getting everything apart. Get it all apart. Get it in tubs of citric acid and water. Desalinate, and then it can go on to be decorroded, media blasted, zinc plated.
Right.
And then that will stop the corrosion.
Yeah. So we're air day today, but what's next on the to-do list for you?
It's just continue getting this barracuda apart that's come out of the Solent.
Yeah.
Which means a bit of downtime on DP872, as in putting things together and getting it built up. But in the long run, it will help tremendously in progressing the project.
Okay. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you, Peter.
When was the first time of this kind of aeroplane built?
The first ones were built in the early 40s.
So that's 1940, yeah? So your granddad, my dad, he didn't fly in them until 1944. Okay?
Quite new. After.
Well, there's none left. All the thousands they made.
Why did they just get rid of them?
That's a very good question, Beatrice. We'll ask Will that. Why did they get rid of them, Will?
I'd ask Tony that.
Tony?
Yeah.
Right. Should we go and ask Tony that question? Come on then. Let's go and ask Tony. Where's Tony?
Down here.
Why did they get rid of all of these aeroplanes? Why did they get rid of them?
Well, it's probably because at the time they were considered outdated and being at the time replaced by newer aircraft that had newer technology in them, which probably weren't as maintenance intensive as these ones, which were left over from the World War II. So that's probably why.
How do they like make it look new?
How do you make it look new?
It's called engineering magic. Basically, we clean up all the old parts, we take everything apart, so where they're held in with nuts and bolts and rivets, we take all those out, we clean up what's left, we strip all the old paint off, for example, we clean off any corrosion, we treat the areas where it was corroded so it's not going to corrode again, and then we put anti-corrosion preservative on it, and then we paint it, and we put it all back together with new nuts and bolts and rivets, and it almost looks like new. In fact, it looks probably newer than it did when it was new, simplistically. Because we're trying to do a better job than when they did in the wartime, when they made them so quickly, because we were at war with Germany and Japan. They needed to get them out to the guys who were going to fly them to fight the war, whereas we can take our time and take a little bit more care in what we do.
Yeah?
When did you start building this plane, that one?
This plane here was 2012, if I'm correct, was the kickoff of the project.
So,
yes, Will has confirmed, 2012. So we've been doing this for 7 years now, or Will has at least. I've only been helping for the last 2.5 years. So, and we've got a couple of years left, haven't we, to finish it off, like the rest of our lives, for example.
You started when I was just dead tiny.
Yes, indeed. And you're going to be quite big by the time it's finished. And you will probably have children of your own by then too, to be honest.
But we will definitely come down and see it when it gets, when it's ready, won't we? Yeah, see what Grandad flew in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
As soon as the cockpit's ready, you can have a sit in the cockpit.
Wow, we'll do that.
We might even do something with the seat as well.
Yeah.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
With the Navy Black Cat display now in the air, I was lucky enough to speak to Lieutenant Chris Rebeck, who's flying the Wildcat today, about the return of the Black Cats and what's involved in getting his PDA.
I'm Lieutenant Chris Rebeck. I'm a qualified helicopter instructor here on 825 Squadron at Yeovilton, and I also do the Black Cats display for the 2019 season.
Right, thank you very much, Chris, for joining us. You've already answered three of my questions. You are, of course, the pilot of the Black Cats display team. Tell us what's happened, because they've been missing for a while, and it's the first season back.
Yeah, they displayed every season for about 14 or 15 years. 2016 was the last time they displayed. I was Black 2 that year.
Okay.
In the second aircraft. And because of transition and the pinch point operational requirements and the lack of resources, we had to take a break in 17 and 18. And this is now the regeneration of the Black Cats. And this year it will be a solo display. But the ambition, of course, is to return to a two-ship display.
Right, okay. And it's the Wildcat this time as well. How different is flying the Wildcat in a display to flying the Lynx?
It's very different. I mean, the Wildcat has displayed as the Black Cats before in 14, 15 and 16. But as a solo, this is the first year that we're doing that. So it's a more dynamic display. In comparison to the Lynx, it is heavier, but it's got a lot more power to cope with that weight.
Okay.
But it retains that semi-rigid rotor head of the Lynx. So in terms of its manoeuvrability around the sky, it's a brilliant piloting aircraft.
So its envelope isn't restricted at all for the display?
No, the envelope remains similar to the Lynx. It's up to 90 degrees angle of bank and in pitch, and we've now got a bit more power to play with, and speed limited to about 160 knots, but if I'm honest, we're using about 130-140 during the display anyway, so we're not reaching that limit.
So Chris, tell us what's your career background? How do you manage to get to the front seat of the Black Cats?
Well, the first bit was pretty standard, going through officer training in the Royal Navy and going through the elementary flying training part. But when I came here onto the Lynx fleet in about 2011, I went frontline, transitioned to Wildcat in 2015, and it was then when I was selected to be Black 2. And so it's my experience really in that display circuit that has allowed me to be the selected one this year to regenerate the display.
Now, you've just got your PDA, I think, last week.
We did.
What's involved in doing that? What does the PDA entail?
So at first it entails a lot of training as we build up to that day, and that's taking it from grassroots, doing the manoeuvres individually, to then sequencing them together. And once we're happy we've done that and the supervisor here, who is monitoring our training throughout, is content, we then get our admiral down, head of the fleet air arm, Rear Admiral Connell came down, and he watches the display from start to finish and gives it his seal of approval that it's safe and good to go and commit in front of the public.
And how much involvement do you have in designing the actual display you're going to put on? Is it something that's scripted for you, or do you have a role in helping to form that display pattern?
No, we have complete authority over the design of it. As long as it's within the limits of the aircraft and is safe, we can design whatever we want. We then have to have that looked at by, you know, experts here who have flown the Wildcat for a long time, and they will look at it and give it, you know, whether it is suitable or not. At that point, we'll start training to it.
Yeah. Exciting stuff. What can we expect to see in the display then?
So this year, rather than the Black Cats pair, which was all about sequencing and two helicopters flying together very closely, we can afford to be more dynamic now because it's just me. I'm not risking hitting another helicopter in close proximity. So it should be more dynamic. You know, the wingovers will have more angle of bank. They'll be higher. There'll be more energy in the climbs, and the maximum speeds we'll be getting to. You know, it's hopefully going to be more dynamic for the public to see.
Well, we're very excited to see it. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Sound of six Merlins from the Battle of Britain Memorial flight.
Thank you.
It's the end of the day and it can only be a jungly commando assault. Leading the display today is Lieutenant Commander Andy White from the Commando Helicopter Force. Resplendent in his white Royal Navy uniform, I was intrigued about the crossover of Royal Navy and Royal Marine staff flying the Merlin. But first, I asked him what the commando assault is all about.
Hello, I am Lieutenant Commander Andy White from 846 Naval Air Squadron, which is part of the Commando Helicopter Force.
Right, thanks very much for joining us today. You have the responsibility for the end of show spectacular. For those who haven't seen it yet, what can they expect?
Well, thank you for having me. So for the Commando Assaults grand finale, we've got aircraft from across the Commando Helicopter Force, as well as other guests, Royal Marine commandos involved, that we will try and put on as dynamic and exciting a show for people as we can, really. So there'll be explosions, there'll be gunfire going off, all safe and blanks, but just to really demonstrate kind of what an opposed landing of Royal Marines using the Commando Helicopter Force might look like.
Right, okay. Very excited to see the show. Tell me about your career, though. How did you get to be in the role you are today, and what link has that got to aviation?
Okay, so I joined in 2007, went through officer training at the Royal Naval College in Dartmouth, then flying training after that. I used to fly Lynx Mark 7 before that went out of service, and then transferred onto the Commando Merlin.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's a very quick summary of your career. There's got to be a bit more of it in that. Where have you served?
So I've served pretty much all over, and so as the Commando Helicopter Force, we deploy anywhere where the Royal Marines go, effectively. So I've done Afghanistan, lots of amphibious deployments, so time in the Middle East on aircraft carriers with an amphibious task force, so pretty much all over, really.
Now, the Merlin's still relatively new to service. I think it's starting to prove its worth. Tell us what it's like to fly and how it is for the commandos to use as an airborne assault ship.
It's a beautiful aircraft to fly. It's a big step up from the old Sea King, which, although was loved by all, is now retired from the Commando Helicopter Force. Merlin is great. It gives us much more lift. We can fly more troops further, faster, and we can deliver them in a better state at the other end. We're now getting an uplift of the new Mark IV Commando Merlin, which has folding head, folding tail, to make it easier to deploy on ships. Also upgraded avionics, so it's a thoroughly lovely aircraft, and it's a really exciting time, really.
Right, okay, let's come back to the display then. How do you go about preparing something like this? It's not just the commandos and the Merlins involved, is it? It's multi-ship, multi-aircraft, ground troops. How do you go about planning and preparing for something that complex?
Well, it takes quite a while, and quite a lot of effort goes into making sure that, firstly, it's safe, but secondly, that it's dynamic and exciting and something that people want to hang around for at the end of the air day. And it's a great opportunity for us to work up quite a good capability, interoperability with the Marines, the various squadrons across the Commando Helicopter Force, different aircraft types, and also other aircraft that we draft in to help us on the day. There's a lot to it, but it's thoroughly worthwhile, and we get some great training out of it. But there's a few people that are rather busy for the few weeks leading up to it.
And before we started recording, we were talking about careers in the Navy, and the commandos, Royal Marines, have their own identity, their own approach. Tell us about careers in the Navy and particularly in the Royal Marines. What could people expect to be involved in and to do, and how exciting a career is it?
Okay, so the Commando Helicopter Force is reasonably unique that we've got a mixture of Royal Navy and Royal Marines personnel manning the across the force, really. So that gives us the capability to be able to deploy on ships and also ashore and support the Royal Marines when they go ashore, which means that we then recruit from all over, across the Marines and across the Royal Navy. So for example, pilots, you can either join the Marines first, we recruit officers from the Marines, or you can join the Royal Navy as a pilot and then get selected into the Commando Helicopter Force. So, yeah, we look for people with the acumen as opposed to necessarily the qualifications. Yeah. So, 2A levels, I think, is the minimum, and guys will get a degree out of their training.
You don't have to have a degree to get in, then?
No, so... yeah, just with those, with A levels or equivalents, yeah. People then join up, they go through flying training, and all the training that's given to them is accredited for a degree once they finish their training. So, yeah. Good way to not get that student debt, be paid to go flying, get qualifications, and gain a degree.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, and we're looking forward to the display.
Thank you.
That's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. We'd also like to thank Mick Oakey and his team at the Aviation Historian for helping to promote the programme. Don't forget, you can leave us feedback on iTunes or your podcast playing app. Like our Facebook page and score us on any of your podcast players on our Facebook page, or send us a message on Twitter. You can find Extended Now on all of the popular podcast players and, of course, on iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, so please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license. You can find Tim on Twitter at RAES, Tim R, and Gareth you can find at Gareth_Stringer. You can find me, Peter Johnson, at NASCOT Hornet on Twitter, and you can find me lurking around on our Facebook page and the extended Twitter feed. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from me, Amanda and Beatrice from the 2019 Royal Navy International Air Day.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
It's taken me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended.
This is XTP Media.